sir.
Thanks, John. My name is Norris Hammond, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. I always introduce myself that way because if you ever get over in the Florence, Muscle Shoals, Sheffield, Tuscumbia area, that's the way everybody knows me. And if you start looking for me, I probably need you, so I want you to be able to find me, okay? God shook this mountain with an earthquake a few days ago. And this mountain shook me this weekend. Whew, what a deal. What a deal. When Milton walked up to me and we were in Columbus, Mississippi, and asked me to think about coming up here, I didn't have a clue, pal. Thanks a lot. Lorenda and I both want to thank you so much, the committee. This has been one of the most remarkable experiences of my life. We're even thinking about selling our TV when we get home. Geez, we got here and we started walking around and looking, and I said, you know, this is the Episcopal Church has an influence on this thing. And I reminded me of something that I encountered several years ago. I was spent most of my life in radio and television broadcasting, and thinking about the Episcopal Church, I was reminded of a story that a young news reporter covered. There was an airplane flying across the ocean coming in from Europe, trying to make its way into New York City, and it had lost, had engine trouble, and it started throwing out luggage, and they were trying to make it in, and everybody was, of course, watching and praying and hoping, and they were just skimming across the top and finally landed at the airport. And I had a young reporter there, and as the passengers came off the plane, he was interviewing them, and he asked the first guy that came out, I said, what were you thinking out there when you were facing death? And the guy said, well, we're Methodists, and we believe in prayer, and we knew God was going to take care of us. So the next guy came off, and he said, and sir, what were you thinking? He said, oh, we're Baptists, and said, you know us Baptists, said, we just trust in the Lord, and we know that everything's going to be all right. The young reporter was pretty sharp, and he saw that they were thinking along spiritual lines. The next fellow came off, and he asked him, he said, and sir, what denomination are you? And he said, I'm an Episcopalian. And he said, an Episcopalian, what's that? He said, it's an Episcopalian with the piss scared out of him. I've got to tell you, I became an, but they told me I was a Sunday morning speaker. And I was here for that sobriety countdown. And I, boy, at the years of sobriety that was in this room, I became an Episcopalian, I'll tell you right now, I did. I shared this with somebody. They called me up to Tullahoma one time to speak at a birthday deal. And I got up there, and just before they introduced me, I was getting up ready to do my dog and pony show. And three fellas sitting on the front row right there, and a guy that was going to introduce me, he said, do you see those three old fellas up here in the front? And I said, I sure do. He said, they got 97 years between them. I said, thank you for pointing that out to me. You know? Oh, boy. I don't even know where to begin. Took me a long time to get here. I feel like I really am not deserving of the honor that you folks have given me this morning. Then somebody told me one time if I got what I deserved, I'd probably be doing life without parole in a 6x6 married to some guy named Bubba. So I'm grateful for the grace of God that has allowed me to be where I am. It took me a long time to get here. A fellow in our group, and you'll have to meet him sometime, and Howard Jane. Howard talks about getting caught in a speed trap one time. And he said he was speeding through this little town, and they caught him, and this big bad policeman came walking up to him, and he said, boy, I've been waiting on you all day. Howard said, I got here just as quick as I could. That's probably not a good thing to say with the, but truth be known, I got to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous just as quick as I could. It took every drink that I ever took to get me here. John talked about it last night. You know, I believe that my life was saved before I was born. I believe that decision that Bill Wilson made when he elected not to go into the bar, but decided to go to the lounge, to the marquee. You know, he stood there and wrestled with that thought and thought, you know, I need a drink. And I think God reached his hand down and said, no, Bill, you don't need a drink, you need a drunk. And I think that decision is what set in motion the events that saved my life and got me in Mont Eagle today. Gosh, I was a lot smarter than y'all when I got here. A lot of the stuff didn't apply to me. You know, I could switch and swap, and I could do it my way. And consequently, I kept changing my sobriety date a lot, you see. Lorinda talks about it. I got here through the process of elimination. You guys were the last stop on the street for me. I didn't have anywhere else to go. Alcohol had beat me to my knees, and it took that because I'm like so many other people. I felt like I never did fit in, you know. I don't know. And have you guys ever noticed that there's nothing looks like a bottle in a brown paper bag as much as a bottle in a brown paper bag? Now, I was a lot smarter than the average bear. If you guys figured out that that was a bottle in a brown paper bag, I drank vodka so you couldn't smell it. And you know, and this is good stuff too, this is aristocrat vodka. And I realized after I realized that this stuff has actually got a warning on the back of it. And it's a government warning to boot. It says, according to the Surgeon General, women should not drink alcoholic beverages during pregnancy because of the risk of birth defects. Consumption of alcoholic beverages impairs your ability to drive a car or operate machinery and may cause health problems. God, if I'd known that, I'd never drink. But you know what? Good alcoholic that I am, I could rationalize that right away. You see, I was a lot smarter, and a lot of this stuff didn't apply to me because rationalization was my strong suit. I'm certainly not a woman, and I'm not pregnant, so that doesn't apply to me. And for God's sake, I'm not going to operate any machinery, so that doesn't apply to me. And they got to put something on there about health so the Surgeon General can draw his paycheck. So none of that stuff applied to me. Rationalization was my strong suit. Holly Martin, who was one of my heroes, used to say that rationalization is like masturbation. You just screw in yourself in the long run, see. This bottle of aristocrat vodka in the Alabama ABC liquor store cost $2.17. Now that's Alabama tax, brown paper bag, out the door. $2.17. Before we're through, I want to show you where it costs a lot more than that. I want to show you where it costs a radio station, a grocery store, an apartment house, 5 trips to a treatment center, jails, hospitals, and untold pain and suffering. And I ain't going to say nothing new. I'm not going to say anything that hasn't been said by another alcoholic sometime, somewhere in a room just like this. What I might do, I might say it a little differently so it might resonate a little louder, but it'll certainly help me remember where I came from. There's a book that I like. Chuck C. lived in Laguna Beach, California. Chuck talks about in the book how his house set up on a cliff and overlooked the ocean. And he'd sit there in that big easy chair and look out that window, and he'd marvel at the ocean and the sunset. Sit there drunk. When he sobered up, he'd sit in that same easy chair and look out that same window at that same ocean and that same beach. But what he saw drunk and what he saw sober were entirely two different things. Same ocean, same beach, same sunset. What had changed was his perception of what is. And thus he calls his book A New Pair of Glasses. And that's what I want to talk to you about for the next few minutes. I want to talk to you about how my perception has changed about what this fellowship and what even life is for me today. I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous probably 40 years ago. When I walked in the first meeting, there was a podium, blue book, steps and traditions on the wall, and a bunch of folks sitting around talking to one another. When I walk into a meeting today, here you are, a bunch of folks, podium, blue book, steps, traditions, sitting around talking to one another. Same book, same steps. But what I see today and what I saw 40 years ago, entirely two different things. My perception of what this fellowship is and of what life is has totally changed, and that's what I want to spend a few minutes talking about. Credibility. Well, I had 16 years of continuous sobriety once, and then on my 16th birthday, I got my driver's license and I got drunk. I found something I liked. I liked how it tasted. I liked how it made me feel. I even thought it came in pretty bottles. And I began my journey to become a real alcoholic. And if I get real honest, I have to tell you that becoming a real alcoholic is about the only thing I ever stayed at long enough or worked at hard enough to be called a total and complete success at. I grew up in a little town called Lexington, Alabama. My family was in the grocery business and the dollar store business, and that kept me sick for a lot of years, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. I graduated from high school and won a little public speaking contest and went off to Nashville to learn how to be a radio announcer, the Middle Tennessee School of Broadcasting. Came back and went to Martin, got a job at a radio station in Pulaski, Tennessee. And while I was there, went to Martin College. Fell in love with a little girl. We were talking about getting married and still drinking. Now, at this point in my life, drinking had not caused me any problems, or rather, I had not had to pay the consequences of drinking. There are two things I can't stand, an empty bottle or a full. I always had to have it going somewhere in between. I abused alcohol the first time I drank, and I abused alcohol the last time I drank. So, as far as I'm concerned, normal is a setting on a washing machine. I have no concept of what normal is. Miss Carol and I were talking about getting married back in those days, and she said to me one day, she said, "Norris, someday you're going to make somebody a good husband, but it's not going to be me because you drink too much." Whoa. That gave me a perfect excuse to ratchet my drinking to another level. And then, rocket scientist that I am, I began to rationalize and think about that situation, and I thought, now, I'll do the only logical thing. What I'm going to do is join the Army. Made sense to me now. Vietnam is about to crank up, and I'm thinking, I'll go off to the war. I'll be a war hero, and when I come home, she's going to love me. Made sense to me. So I did. I joined the Army and volunteered for about everything that I could volunteer for. And that's a whole nother story for a whole nother time, because they like to have killed me. I wound up going through jump school and ranger training and special forces and all that stuff. I did a tour of duty in Vietnam, Germany. They kicked me out of an airplane 52 times, and when I got out of the Army 4 years later, I was not a war hero. I was a loose cannon. I was literally a loose cannon. I was in and out of every radio station in North Alabama and southern Middle Tennessee. I did not want anything getting in the way of my drinking, so I obviously didn't want to work. What would happen, I would always wind up back in Lexington, Alabama, working in the family grocery business. That was my safety net, and that's what I used for a lot of years. I could go out and do all these crazy things and come right back home. My pattern back in those days, we lived about 6 or 7 miles from the Tennessee state line. Had some beer joints up there, so I could go up there and have a few beers. And I'd think, well, you know, I can go off up Pulaski, which is 12, 15 miles up the road. They've got some Aristocrat vodka up there. So I'd charge off up to Pulaski and start having a few drinks. And then, rocket scientist that I am, I'd think, well, now, if I go back through Minor Hill, they're going to catch me. So what I better do is spend the night. So I'd get me a motel room with one mission: to drink myself into oblivion. I would drink and pass out, drink and pass out. And I would stay there until something moved me off dead center. Either I'd run out of money, nobody take a check, or my dad or some of my family would come and get me. And you know, I can remember my dad would come and get me, and we'd sit there on that couch. And after I'd been on a 3-day drunk, and he'd say to me, he'd say, "Norris, why don't you do that?" He'd say, "Don't you know when you take a drink, you're going to get drunk?" And I'd say, "Yeah." He'd say, "Why do you take that first drink then?" And you know what, folks? I gave him the only answer that I knew. And every 5-year-old kid in the world knows the answer: just cause. Just cause. You can take a 5-year-old kid with a claw hammer in his hand. He's just broke out the picture window. And you ask him, "Why did you do that?" And he'll tell you: just cause. I did not know what was wrong with me. My family did not know what was wrong with me. I would try to quit. See, what would happen, I'd go out and try to have a few beers with the boys, but I'd always hear the bartender say that famous statement: "You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here." See, I'd close a joint down every time, and I didn't know why. One time somebody told me I needed religion. Somebody else told me I needed companionship. Gosh, one time I had two different religions and somebody else's companion, and hell, I'd still get them drunk, you know. I have to tell you, if you're new in the program, don't be too hard on the people around you who don't understand this disease, okay? My family only saw my behavior, you know, and that's what other people see in us, is our behavior. Now, we live over in Florence on the Tennessee River. Fishermen come from all over the world to fish in that lake, and fish swim in schools. And they've gotten pretty sophisticated about catching those fish. And they've got all kinds of equipment and whatever. And can you imagine, this fisherman drops this bait off down into that school of fish, and this fish sees it, and he thinks he's found dinner. But when he bites into it, he feels that hook, and he feels the pain. And he begins to try to get away, and the more he tries to get away, the more pain he feels and the tighter he gets caught. And he begins to splash and dive, and the other fish looking at him, and they wonder what's wrong. They think, why is he acting that way? Why is he not normal? You see, the other fish can't see the hook. All they see is his behavior. And that's the way. I had a preacher friend one time, not too awfully long ago, and he lost a son in a head-on car wreck. And he said to me, he said, it's the first time he'd ever had anybody close to him killed. He said, "You know what, Norris?" He said, I have preached many funerals. And he said, "I've stood there at the head of that casket and shook hands with that family and said, 'You have my sympathy.'" He said, "I didn't have a clue. I didn't know what I was talking about." And I couldn't resist the temptation to tell him that he could better understand why one old drunk can talk to another old drunk, because you can see my hook. You can feel my pain. I got married in 1971, I guess it was, and we went off to Marietta, Georgia to work. I was working in a grocery store. I apologize, this allergy thing has hit me, but anyway, forgive me. We were in Marietta, Georgia working. My brother-in-law was manager of a big grocery store over there. My son was born over there in 1972. May 16th. Matter of fact, he got a birthday coming up, 31 years ago, I guess. The morning he was born, I started drinking to celebrate and wound up getting a DUI and spent the night in jail. Georgia was not working out for us, so I took that famous geographic cure again, came back to Florence, Alabama. Sam Phillips had bought a couple of radio stations, and he decided I needed to be his news director, so I went to work and was doing news, and I was doing play-by-play sports for the University of North Alabama and traveling with the team and that sort of thing. We were doing the coach's show on television, and I got drunk on television. So you know what happened to that job. A couple of friends of mine were putting a new radio station back on the air in Pulaski, Tennessee, in 1974, and I went up there and went to work, and I had come full circle. I was right back where I started, working at a radio station in Pulaski, Tennessee. See, if nothing changes, nothing changes. Somebody said it yesterday. If you keep on doing what you always done, you always get what you always got. I had been drunk for a couple of weeks. I'd run my wife and son off. They'd come back to Lexington, and a lawyer and a mechanic made a 12-step call on me, and they asked me if I thought I had a drinking problem. And I would have admitted to anything to have gotten out of the situation I was in. Hell, I would have admitted to shooting President Kennedy if I thought it would have done me any good. They tossed me in the back of a car and carried me to the VA hospital in Murfreesboro, Tennessee in 1975. I went through their 8-day detox program, went through their 28-day program, came back, negotiated myself into a position buying a radio station over in Perry County, Tennessee. I tell everybody Perry County is not the end of the world, but you can see it from there. Uh, 1976, I was not drinking. You know, I wasn't doing anything except just not drinking. Working, we had that radio station going. My wife had a little variety shop. We had an apartment house and some cars and stuff. Anyway, 1976, America was 200 years old, and had a party down at my house, and I hadn't drank. And I don't know, a week or so after that, I was down in the kitchen making a ham sandwich, and I opened the lettuce drawer to get some lettuce out, and there was a Miller Pony in there. And I took that Miller Pony out and undone it and drank it down and threw it in the garbage can, and 6 years later, I lit. I had lost a radio station, apartment house, everything. I tell everybody I reached my break-even point financially. I owed about as many people as I didn't owe. And we slipped out of Perry County, Tennessee on the cover of darkness and came back to Lexington, Alabama so I could work in the family business because they needed me, see. Truth of the matter was, they're the only folks that would have anything to do with us. In those days, I went to the treatment center again. I went to another, that's the second time. My second treatment center was the VA hospital in Tuscaloosa. And my pattern had changed a little bit. I'd binge drink, you know. And Lexington is 10 miles north of Joe Wheeler Dam. Now, if you look on the map, anything, the Tennessee River at Joe Wheeler Dam is exactly a mile long. And that dam is narrow. And the liquor store is on the opposite side of that dam where I need to go. And I'm a shaker. I can't save a drink. And I get in bad shape. And I discovered that a 24-ounce bottle of Listerine would settle me down enough that I could drive a motor vehicle across that dam to get to a liquor store. Now, it's important for y'all to know that Listerine's not my drug of choice. If you drink it, you don't have plaque and gingivitis and a lot of other stuff that you otherwise might have. It's also the cunning, baffling part of this disease is I drank Listerine because I had to, not because I wanted to. I suffer from what the Big Book calls the phenomenon of craving. And when I take a drink of alcohol in any shape, form, or fashion, my body says to me one thing. It says, get me some more of that stuff and get it quick. And I respond by getting some more of that stuff, no matter if it's Listerine. I was in a stone blackout in 1982 on Listerine trying to get to the liquor store, had a wreck, hit a lady, wound up in a DUI school. Thank God I didn't kill anybody. I was trying to do all the stuff I needed to do to get out of what I had gotten myself into, and they ran this tape about this lady doctor who was doing cancer research down in Houston, Texas, and you guys know the story, where she needed warm brain tissue, and she'd ride around with the Houston Police Department. When they'd find these Skid Row bums that had died, she'd rush them back to the hospital and do an autopsy. And she made a remark one day that it's strange that all these winos were also hooked on heroin. They laughed at her and said, you know, these guys can't afford a cheap bottle of Muscatel, let alone heroin. And what she discovered was that the way some of us process alcohol when we take a drink creates or manufactures this tetrahydroisoquinoline, this THIQ stuff in the base of the brain. And I saw that, and I said, run that by me again. I want to see that again. And I remember it as well as if it were yesterday. I thought, do you suppose that there is something physically wrong with me that makes me do what I do? That I am not just a low-life, no-good so-and-so? And I hung my hat on that, and I began my journey to recovery. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous every day at noon and started trying to work these steps as best I could. And I got me a sponsor, and we plugged along, and life got pretty good. 5 years went by. I was working in that same DUI school where I got sober. I was doing an early morning television talk show with a new TV station we'd put on the air. I was actually working in a treatment center doing some marketing for them. And then in 1988, my disease talked to me. And my disease talks to me, and it usually disguises itself as common sense. And my disease said to me that day, it said, Norris, now you got this THIQ stuff and you can't drink. And I said, you betcha, I know what's going to happen if I do. And it said to me, it said, Norris, you might smoke a joint. Made sense to me, a rocket scientist that I am. I smoked a joint, and within 48 hours, I had a half a gallon of what I like. 48 more hours, I was back in treatment. This time, I was down in Warrior at Birmingham. Now, that's three, if y'all are counting. Gosh, we don't have a clock. I got to hurry up and get sober here. I'm probably not going to need the whole 2 hours. Somebody told me one time, now in these speaker meetings, here's the deal. They said, everybody's got a job. Y'all's is to listen, mine is to talk. If y'all get through before I do, just take off. It don't matter. I don't know. I had a counselor down at that Warrior Tree. He didn't like me. He told me I was the lowest piece of scum God had ever made, and it was down there that I learned that prayer don't work, because I prayed every day, night and day, actually, for him to die, and he didn't. But I did that 28 days, and if you know anything about Warrior, there's a Wayne's package store just before you get on Interstate 65, and I showed him who was in charge of my life right there. That's where I got drunk at him. In 1989... God gave me the job that I have today, the company that I work for today. It allows me to travel Alabama and Mississippi. I was still drinking. I got caught for another DUI in Mississippi, and I went back to treatment, this time over in Center Alabama, self-discovery, and that's four, y'all. Came out of treatment, still didn't do anything. Nothing changes. I'm just having a run of bad luck, y'all. I'm smarter than y'all. I don't need to do this like this. This doesn't apply to me. I got caught for another DUI in Lauderdale County. And there is a judge over there. Her name is Judge Deborah Bell Passour. And I had to go to her court. She had been a friend of mine. I had known her, used to work for her in the DUI program. And I don't mind telling you, I hated going to her court. As fate would have it, her dad, who was a judge in Birmingham, relapsed about the same time I did after 20 years of sobriety. She worked everybody out of the courtroom, and she called me in her office and sat me down, and she said, "Norris, I don't want to see you wind up like my father. He can't stop drinking. He won't go back to AA. He's killing himself, and I can't reach him." And I said, "Deborah, what do you want me to do?" She said, "I want you to go back to treatment." I said, "My God, I've been four times." And I know why she's a judge. I know why all that background and education and brilliance, and she drew on all that, and she looked me in the eye, and she said, with all her wisdom, "You must have missed something." So you know what I did? I decided I would go back to where I started. I went back to the VA hospital in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And this was 1993, and that's my sobriety day. I took my last drink on the last day of July. And because I had come full circle, here I was right back at the VA hospital in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I kept on doing what I'd always been doing, and I kept on getting what I always got. And you know what? We read in the promises, and God knows I love those promises. It says that God will do for us what we can't do for ourselves. And when I got there, they really didn't know I was there until it was time for me to go. They were in the process of changing directors and counselors and all this kind of stuff. And I got a counselor assigned to me the week I was supposed to leave. And what that allowed, I think God knew what I needed, because had somebody jumped in my stuff like the guy in Warrior did, I'd have probably done that. And not taking anything away from him, he thought he was doing the right thing, but this alcoholic at that time in my life didn't need that, I don't think. I redid a fourth step. I did a lot of reading. And when I came away, I had a new pair of glasses. If I knew this program before, from the head up, I felt it. I stopped trying to work it, and I started trying to live it. And it was different. And you know, the book tells us that our dilemma is lack of power. And for this alcoholic, I have discovered that for me, the power, I'm granted this daily reprieve on contingent upon my spiritual condition. And the power for this drunk, I find in the 11th step, when I'm lined up with God's will. You know, it is a wonderful feeling to know you're where you're supposed to be, doing what you're supposed to be doing at the moment. Now, I got to tell you, and Lorinda tells me I need to share, how do I know I'm in God's will? I got to tell you, we talk a lot about serenity, and we talk a lot about spirituality. Some days I don't know that I know what spirituality is. But I know what it's not. Some days I don't know that I know what serenity is, but I know what it's not. Some days I don't know that I know what God's will is, but I know what it's not. And it's just as important some days for me to know what something is not as for me to know what something is, you see. Dr. Paul says on page 452, or used to be 452, he says, "You know, I never sit around just waiting on God to tell me what to do, but do whatever's in front of me to be done. And however that turns out, that's God's will for me today," you see. And I started trying to use that. And I've got a little camera in my car. Sometimes I have to take some pictures. And it's got two lines, focus lines. And you know what, folks, if I get those lines lined up and take a picture, comes out great. But if it's not, if it's out of focus, you can't tell what it is. And I equate that with my will and God's will. You see, when I'm lined up, things come great. And my task is to stay out of the way, is to keep myself spiritually fit. So all the stuff that I do, this praying every morning and thanking God for keeping me sober at night and trying not to harm anybody today and tell the truth because I can't remember if I tell a lie. All that stuff and try to pay back and clean up some of this crap that I've done, all of that keeps me, hopefully, God even trusts me every now and then to carry a message, you see. God, is a wonderful story about Gary from South Mississippi tells it, about the atheist who was lost in a snowstorm in Alaska. And this atheist was telling his friend, he said, my gosh, he said, I'd been out there for days and I was about to die. He said, I'd never believed in God. He said, I didn't know how I was going to get out. You know, I was about gone, and finally I'd give up. I tried everything else, and I cried out. And I said, okay, God, if you're out there, I'm hung. I got to have some help. And this guy he was talking to said, and he answered your prayer. And this atheist said, oh, no, an Eskimo came along, and I followed him out. See, God puts Eskimos in my life to carry the message. And some days he even lets me be an Eskimo. The first time I became so keenly aware of it, I had a friend, gosh, this has been 7 years ago. 7 years ago. My kid and his kid grew up, and Al came to me. He said, Daddy, he said, won't you try to talk to Jamie? He said, he's killed himself, and he can't do nothing, and anyway, drinking. And I'm not an evangelist, so I didn't knock on the door. But I had gone to Gulf Shores to work, and I worked sales, and if I don't sell stuff, I don't make money. I mean, it's that simple. And I had gone down there, and the people that I had, it was 12th day of January, and I went down there, and they didn't nobody want to see me. I mean, everybody I went down there to see was gone. Monday came and went. Tuesday came and went. I'm throwing good money after bad. I mean, it's not that nobody's telling me, no, I don't want to buy this. I ain't seeing. There ain't nobody talking to me. So I'm at home. I said, I got to come back. So I'm throwing good money after bad, and I come home. And I'm in my office of a thing, and I got the house, and I'm going through my stuff, and a phone rings, and it's Jamie's wife. And he wants to talk to me. Then I knew why I wasn't supposed to be in Gulf Shores. I'm supposed to be in Lexington, Alabama, because that's when. And I got to him. He was as near drunk as anybody. I mean, as near dead as anybody ever seen. Had a half a gallon of pop-off vodka sitting on the bar. And he said, can I have a drink of that? He couldn't get up. He's a big, robust kind of a guy. And I said, yeah, you can have that. You can have a drink. You can drink all of it you want to today. He said, I'll go where you went. Carried him to Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and he ain't had a drink since, see. When I'm lined up, see, and what a joy to be a part of that. My company sends me projections where I work a town a week, and I got 90 days leeway where I can go. When I was over in Center, Alabama, there's a dude over there, George M. And they had sent me, he lived in Roanoke, Alabama. And they had sent me Roanoke to go work. And I'd look at my projection, I'd throw Roanoke over, and I'd go somewhere else, and I'd look, and I'd throw Roanoke over, and I'd go to Albertville. And one night I got a phone call, it was on Friday, and I got a phone call, and it was George from Roanoke. And George said, I was going through some stuff, Norris, and I found a Christmas card you had sent me, and it had your phone number on it. He said, I just needed to talk to a friendly voice. And then I knew why I've been throwing Roanoke over. I said, George, I'm coming to Roanoke. He said, when? I said, tomorrow. You see, it's all about being lined up. It's all about doing God's deal because he's driving the bus. I ain't. I made a mess when I drove the bus. So what I got to do is get out of the way, you see. And I had an experience I got to pay back this last week. Another similar thing. And we had, Lorraine and I talked to a friend of ours in his grocery store at Christmas, I guess, wasn't it, babe? He got a brother, and he said, you know, he's killed himself, same story. When we left it, he said, if he ever wants to talk to anybody, call us. Well, last Monday week, I had gone to Selma, Alabama to work. Monday, I get down there. Nobody wants to see me. I'm spinning my wheels. And I told her, I said, I'm coming home. I'm going to try to go to Moulton because we need to make some money. Tuesday morning, I'm coming through Birmingham on my way back home. She calls me. She says, guess what? I know why Selma didn't come together. Because you're supposed to go see Brad. He had called. I went to see him and spent all day with him Wednesday. Needed to be at work. Finally got him in hospital that night about 9:30 to get detoxed. Needed to be at work. Next day I went to Moulton. People flagged me down in the road to buy my stuff. It's about being lined up. See, it's about being lined up. And God, I wouldn't, you know, what we have today, this... I had open heart surgery in 1998. I stayed in a relationship for a long time for a lot of the wrong reasons. I kept thinking, you know, I'm going to get her fixed and she's going to be okay. And it never worked that way. I realized in 1998 that I wasn't 10 feet tall and bulletproof and wasn't going to live forever. So I got divorced and moved on, tried to, and did. Saw Lorenda walk into an AA meeting hall, I don't know how many years ago now, 8, I guess. Never knew that we'd be anything but friends. Our relationship changed. God had different ideas about that deal. And we got married last year. And I adopted a beautiful little 10-year-old girl at the same ceremony. What a deal! Oh, my God, you would not believe what this life is. It is beyond anything I have ever experienced, ever dreamed of would happen. See, most of my life, I thought I needed to hurry up and accomplish something. I want to hurry up and be somebody. I just need a better car, bigger house, better job, and then I'm going to be happy. And I finally realized that happiness is found along the way, not at the end of the road. It's all about the journey. It's not about the destination. All the fun comes in the building. Back a few years ago, my kid, when Al was just little, my son, he was, I don't know, 10 or 12 years old, and a guy let him use a building, a vacant building. And they was going to build him a clubhouse, a hideout. And all the little boys in the neighborhood, they had brooms and mops and hammers and nails, and they'd go in after school and they'd work and they'd clean and they work. You'd have to go get them when it get dark. I mean, they worked and worked. And then one day they got it built, and it wasn't any fun anymore. All the fun is in the building. It's all about the journey. It's not about the destination. There's a great story about two fish swimming in the ocean. Two young fish, and they saw this wise old fish over there, and he was purported to know everything. And they thought, you know what, if we swim over there next to him, maybe he'll tell us something that we really need to know that would help us make it through life. So they swam over there next to him, and he looked down at him, and he said, "Isn't the water great today?" And swam off. And they looked at each other, and they said, "What's water?" And they spent the rest of their life swimming the ocean over looking for the water. See, that's what I was doing. I was plowing through life, missing all the living, missing all the little stuff, missing the water. Happiness is found along the way, not at the end of the road. It's about the journey, not the destination. Thank God for that. Thank God for that. What we have today, Amber, our 10-year-old, she wanted to be a Hammond. We had the wedding ceremony and the adoption ceremony, and I put a ring on her finger, and she won't take it off. She won't take it off. She went to work with me 2 or 3 weeks ago, carried her on the road with me, and just a deal, see, just a deal. Lorenda called me. I don't know, I was working in Anniston. She called me a month or two ago, crying, 11:30 at night, going through Amber's book bag, signing her papers to take back to school. And one of her assignments had said, "Tell me about your special place." And this 10-year-old had written, "My special place is my home because it's filled with love." Coming from where two old drunks come from, that's a direct side effect, result of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the spiritual principles that apply here. God, I love this fellowship. You know, I told you that was $2.17. Imagine with me for a minute if it could talk. And I said to this vodka, to this last drink for this drunk, if I said, "How much do you cost?" And he says to me, "How much have you got?" And I say, "Well, I got $50. He says, "Well, I'll take that." And I say, "But I can't give you $50, but I got to have gas for my car." "Still got a car?" "I take the car too, because the price just went up." And I say, "But I can't lose that car, because if I didn't have that car, how would I get to work?" "You still got a job." "Well, the price keeps going up." And I say, "But if I lost my job, what would my family do?" "Family? Still got a family. So the price keeps going up. He'll take the family too." And I say, "But man, if I lost my family, I'd just die." He says, "Yeah, that's the cost, that drink for this drunk." See, the book says we deal with alcohol, cunning and baffling and powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now. God bless, and thank you for letting me share.